Well, my name's Josh Lawrence, and I'm really happy to be here. I'm really happy to be invited to this great workshop. I've learned a lot. I have a kind of longstanding collaboration with Francis Skinner, and more recently, after moving to Montana, I've been involved in lots of collaborations with Emily Stone, so some of you may know her. She wasn't able to come to this workshop, but she was able to attend the Parkinson's and was able to connect with a few people. So I feel a little awkward not having Emily in the audience to field some of the mathematical questions, but I'll do the best I can. So I did my PhD thesis work in the lab of Larry Trussell, and I was exposed to modeling, and in a sense, I came out of Larry's lab thinking that my data is not worthy of being explained without a good model. And so I've been looking for collaborations with modelers, and I found one in Francis Skinner's lab with Francis Skinner's lab when I was at the NIH and Chris McBain's lab. So I'm going to briefly go over some of the background, and Yvonne Schultes did a really good job of introducing this idea of cell type specificity and theta oscillations. And so I'm just going to briefly go over, this is the hippocampus, and you lower an electrode down into the hippocampus in an awake behaving animal, you can see theta oscillations generated, which are usually associated with active and learning states. They're about 5 to 12 hertz, and they're involving reciprocal interactions between GABAergic interneurons and principal cells, pyramidal cells of the hippocampus. So if you take a slice through the hippocampus, you can see the organization. There's the pyramidal cell layer that has the pyramidal cells and interneurons that are located in all layers. So there's quite a lot of interneuron diversity in the hippocampus, and Yvonne touched on this. There's morphological diversity, but also neurochemical diversity, as shown by the expression of different neuropeptides, as well as calcium binding proteins and enzymes. So Yvonne alluded to this idea of chronocircuits, and there is a distinct contribution of different interneuron subtypes during theta oscillations. For example, OLM cells fire at the trough, whereas parvalbumin basket cells, they fire at different points in the theta cycle. And he explained that more elegantly than I can. One of the generators of theta oscillations historically is thought to involve the medial septum. So the medial septum contains several different cell types, one of which are GABAergic. And elegant work of Thomas Freund demonstrated that this is a disinhibition circuit in which GABAergic cells project a long distance to the hippocampus and innervate almost exclusively interneuron subtypes, thus creating a kind of a rhythmic disinhibition. And on top of that, there's cholinergic modulation from the medial septum to the hippocampus, and this cholinergic modulation is thought to, these cholinergic fibers are thought to innervate all different cell types in the hippocampus. So normally you have this reciprocal inhibition excitation circuit that generates oscillations, and the early work of Bujaki showed that when you ablate cholinergic neurons from the medial septum, you can greatly attenuate theta oscillations. So there's a cholinergic component to the generation of theta oscillations. And if this is relevant to epilepsy, because overexcitation of cholinergic receptors, which could happen during animal models of epilepsy, for example, pilocarpine-induced seizures. Pilocarpine is a muscarinic receptor agonist, and when it's applied to animals in vivo, rodents in vivo, it can induce epilepsy. And so there's a muscarinic receptor activation can cause a disruption in excitation-inhibition balance, leading to too much excitation. And there are lots of different mechanisms that can underlie this. It could be in part a failure of inhibition or an overexcitation of glutamatergic circuitry. This is also, so that's pilocarpine-induced seizures as an animal model, but it's also relevant to kind of the homeland security issues in which, for example, weaponized nerve gas agents inhibit acetylcholinesterase and cause an increase in, a global increase in acetylcholine level that then leads to epilepsy. And there are studies underway through the Counteract program that aim to try to counteract these nerve gas agents to try to protect, develop new drugs to offset and counteract this kind of epilepsy. There's also a connection between acetylcholine, cholinergic circuitry, and Alzheimer's disease. So in Alzheimer's brains, there's a loss of cholinergic neurons, and there's a comorbidity with epilepsy as well. There's thought to be a loss of interneurons, GABAergic neurons, in both Alzheimer's and epilepsy, and that could potentially shift the balance of excitation and inhibition. So out of the GABAergic neurons in the hippocampus, which ones are sensitive to acetylcholine? Certainly pyramidal cells are, and I guess when I was in Chris McBain's lab, I started to try to understand this. There was an ongoing project in Chris McBain's lab with Andre Fouchon, who showed that M1 receptor knockout mice show an impairment in cholinergically induced oscillations. And that got me into thinking what's known about the roles of acetylcholine modulating these GABAergic interneurons. So basically, at the time, it was really not clear whether there are any organizing principles on how interneurons are being modulated by acetylcholine. There didn't seem to be very much relationship between the morphology and physiology and the way the neurons were modulated. But some work in Cortex by Kawaguchi basically demonstrated that depending on the neurochemical identity of the cell, you can have different responses to either acetylcholine or carbachol or muscarin in the frontal cortex. And that got me thinking that maybe what I should do is simply restrict my study of cholinergic modulation to one particular subtype of interneurons. And so the interneuron that I chose was OLM cells initially. And that was in part because Chris McBain in Bujaki's lab had played a role in discovering these cell types. And they're positioned in stratum oriens, which is thought to be where cholinergic fibers are among the highest in density. So initially, what we did was simply apply muscarin to these cells, these OLM cells. And you can see OLM cells, they have a very characteristic morphology. They project to the distal dendrites and pyramidal cells and lacanopes and molecular air. But they also have a very distinct firing properties in which they have a lot of what is called sag, which is due to the H current. And actually, Vlad from Francis Skinner's lab has a poster outside looking at kind of the more details in this H current in OLM cells. So the response to muscarin basically is this increase in firing frequency that usually happens in the latter part of the current step. This is the 1 second current step, and you can see that initially there's a slowing in axitential frequency, but that's reversed and becomes an acceleration, as you can see in plotting the second half of the pulse in this frequency. There's also a large after depolarization that's generated, and it's very reliable and consistent across OLM cells. And if you and you apply a voltage clamp command right at the offset of this current step, you can see the generation of a large inward current, which we think is mediated by a trip channel. We went on to show that when you introduce kind of theta-like sinusoidal input into the OLM cell, the muscarin will increase the firing reliability in response to this the sinusoidal input. And you can see the, these overlaid traces here. So you get an increase in the spike probability, but you also get a phase shift. And if we can do, we did pairwise comparisons in spike timing and convolved it with a Gaussian distribution and multiplied the these Gaussian distributions together to get a reliability index. And you can see that, that there's a peak near theta frequency, and you, and in the population, it tends to actually narrow the band theta frequency in the presence of muscarins. So in collaboration with Francis Skinner's lab, Fernando Sarriega and I worked together to develop a an OLM interneuron model, and this is one of Fernanda's models that we've essentially termed Richie. So what she did was she integrated, we had another paper that characterized the M current in these cells. And basically she integrated the M current into these OLM models, and we were able to reproduce the effects of the of M current block or enhancement. So XD991 is an antagonist, and retigabine, which is also an is an anticonvulsant, was we were able to essentially reproduce the experimental findings in these this multi-compartmental model of the OLM cell, and also reproduce the responses in voltage clamp in detection of the M current. We are also able to reproduce the sinusoidal input, although I believe that the phase shifting was not present. So from there, we were kind of interested. We saw that this had this big, really nice response to muscarin in OLM cells. In other stratum orion cell types, which we still don't quite understand, there wasn't this strong after depolarization that occurred. And we have some ideas for what these stratum orion cell types are that don't respond to muscarin. But what we wanted to do next was to ask whether the neurochemical identity specifically had anything to do with the response to muscarin. So we chose basket cells. So there are two types of basket cells. There's parvalbumin basket cells, which are fast spiking neurons, and then there's CTK basket cells. And in a project with Christian Cia del Rio, who's a graduate student in Chris McBain's lab, we then systematically explored the effects of acetylcholine and muscarin on these different populations of neurochemically distinct populations of basket cells. You can see from this picture that they're essentially thought to be exclusive populations. These are parvalbumin cells, these are GAD65 GFP cells, and they're thought to be just non-overlapping populations. So we chose PVGFP mice in order to target PV basket cells, and GAD65 GFP mice, which are enriched in CTK basket cells in kind of this area between the orions, between radiatum and pyramidal layer. So basically, we found that when we apply muscarin to either PV basket cells or CTK basket cells, we can find a distinct difference in the response to muscarinic receptor activation, in that in the PV basket cells, we get mainly an acceleration in firing frequency and loss of and after hyperpolarization, and then CTK basket cells, we see something reminiscent to what we've already seen in OLM cells. There's an after depolarization, although there's a muscarinic-sensitive AHP here. And so there was basically, we found evidence there's a neurochemical difference in the activation of muscarinic receptors onto either basket cells or CCK, paraboban basket cells or CCK basket cells. So through single-cell PCR, we then explored what the muscarinic receptor subtypes were that are activated by muscarin, and we discovered that the presence of M3 receptors distinguishes the CCK basket cells from the paraboban basket cells. So CCK basket cells had, through single-cell PCR, we were able to show that they had both M1 and M3 receptors, whereas paraboban basket cells had only M1 receptors. And I wanted to point out here that, so we crossed PBGFP mice with an M1 knockout. We were able to eliminate the effects completely in M1 knockout mouse. But in addition, we found that there's a stronger after hyperpolarization that you can see in the M1 knockout mouse, suggesting that there's a tonic activation of M1 receptors in paraboban cells. And I'll come back to that towards the end of my talk. While I was in Chris McBain's lab, I also got interested in presynaptic modulation of muscarin. And in a project towards the end of my time in Chris's lab, I obtained some paired recordings from PBGFP cells and pyramidal cells. And so this is an example of a paraboban basket cell in the PBGFP mouse. You can see it's fast spiking, and when you patch a neighboring pyramidal cell, you can see an increase in iPSCs in response to action tensile initiation. So I examined muscarinic modulation in PD basket cells, and this is also work that was published by Norbert Hayos's group, showing that it's primarily an M2 receptor responsible for it. But you can see that as we wash in muscarin, there's a reduction in inhibitory postsynaptic current amplitude, and there's also postsynaptic depolarization. You can see by an inward current, and there's also changes in the dynamics of short-term plasticity. And so I went on to examine muscarinic receptor modulation in response to trains at either theta frequency or gamma frequency or even 100 hertz frequency. And you can see that these are representative traces. This is normalized traces to the first iPSC. And you can see that initially they're depressing in control conditions. And then there's a knockdown in the amplitude in the presence of muscarin. And when you normalize this, you can see a transient relief of depression at 5 hertz, but at 50 hertz, there's an almost complete relief of depression during the whole train. And I also was able to use this data. I did 5 hertz, 50 hertz, and 100 hertz, and I was able to use this data to try to understand the quantal amplitude, the quantal parameters of this the GABAergic transmission onto pyramidal cells. And so what's really nice about paraboban basket cell synapses is that initially during low frequency conditions, you can see that there's a low variance associated with the amplitude of the iPSC. And as you increase in frequency during the train, especially at 50 hertz, you can see that there's an increase in variance, and that towards the end of the train, especially at 1500 hertz, you start to see a lot of failures and lower amplitude. And so this can be plotted in what is called the mean variance plot. And so high amplitudes are low variance. and then low amplitudes or low variance, and then somewhere in the middle there's an intermediate amplitude that's larger variance, and that can be and so this relationship can be plotted. And one of the really interesting things about this mean variance plot is that it can reveal the quantum parameters, not only of quantum amplitude, but also number of active release sites. And the release probability can be worked out by the current divided by the number of release sites in the quantum amplitude. So basically, I took the data and essentially from 5, 50, and 100 hertz, essentially that is 75 release conditions because it was a 25 pulse train in each case. And I plotted the mean and the variance for each of these release conditions. And you can see that it forms a parabola, and the fit to the parabola reveals the number of active release sites, the release probability, and the average quantum amplitude. And that's in control conditions, and in the presence of muscarin, we did not see this parabola. We saw just a linear fit, but the quantum amplitude is similar. So, taking these quantum parameters and the n and the q, we were able to work out the release probability during the train at 5, 50, and 100 hertz. And just recently, not recently, when I arrived at the University of Montana, I met up with Emily Stone and showed her this data, and she's been working on a short-term plasticity model called the FD model. And initially she had used the Dittman and Regier model, but recently she found this Lee et al. Paper from the Poon lab at MIT, and her most recent fits have been really very nice, in which she's been able to fit every single release condition, both in control and muscarin, for each one of those frequencies. And basically, the only thing that she's varying to going from control into muscarin is the entry of calcium into the presynaptic terminal. So we suspect that muscarin is inhibiting presynaptic calcium channels that is accounting for the effect. And just during the meeting, I had a really good conversation with Katie Ferguson from Francis' lab about the idea of integrating this FD model into a network. So this is mostly the kind of just the background is what I was doing in Chris McBain's lab. And about 4 years ago, I started my own lab at the University of Montana, and I'm still interested in cholinergic modulation, and there were lots of remaining questions. So we'd worked out some of the details in the mechanisms underlying muscarinic modulation of OLM cells. We suspect that it's an M current, an inhibition of a AHP current, as well as a trip channel that's underlying it. But there is lots of remaining questions about receptors on other interneuron subtypes, as well as kind of the underlying mechanisms. And initially, as my first R01 grant, I proposed to work out these muscarinic receptor conductances. I was also enamored with the idea of optogenetics, the idea of being able to selectively activate cholinergic neurons that terminate in the hippocampus. And my initial grant was scored but not funded, and it was criticized for being both incremental and too ambitious. And it was because this was kind of this setting the muscarinic sensitive conductances was kind of too much like what I did in OLM cells. And the synaptic activation idea of the optogenetics, I did not really fully test the feasibility. But the overall idea, I guess, I just really got excited about optogenetics, and when I got those scores back, it happened to be at Neuroscience, and I interacted with the Bijaki lab in Tibor Kuz's lab, and within a couple of months, and I'll show you the data, we were able to get that technique established in the lab. So through this, I was really I was still interested in synaptic activation, and there's questions about where the acetylcholine is coming from in the hippocampus, and where's the cholinergic terminals relative to the pyramidal cells and these interneuron subtypes. And some early work from Frotcher and Lorenz basically showed that there can be point-to-point contacts between cholinergic terminals and, in this case, a somatostatin dendrite. And so that got me thinking that there could be these two modes of transmission, a point-to-point transmission as well as volume transmission. And so the idea is that, so the question that I've been trying to ask right now is are there different modes of cholinergic transmission that differ on different interneuron cell types? And so in pyramidal cells, it's thought that they that muscarinic receptors are activated primarily through volumetric transmission. And that might be the case also with interneurons. And so as you step out from the surface of the cell, you'd encounter terminals with some regularity. But there could be also different interneuron subtypes that function primarily through wired transmission, in which a lot of these contacts are right on the cell surface. And you can imagine that there could be different interneuron subtypes that have kind of a different ratio of point-to-point versus volume transmission. And that's kind of really what we're after. And what I was most excited about is using this idea of optogenetics not only to photoactivate acetylcholine onto different interneuron cell types, but also use the YFP that's conjugated to channelrhodopsin to examine the spatial localization of cholinergic afferents. So basically, we started this optogenic technique and had some help from Tibor Kruse and Bujaki to try to get it established. But what we need is a Chat-Cree mouse and a floxed channelrhodopsin YFP virus that we inject into the medial septum right here. And I had the fortune of having a really great technician in the lab. This is April Johnson, who's from who did her undergrad with Charlie Gray at Bozeman. And she's now doing her PhD work in Andre Fouchon's lab at Stockholm. And so initially, these experiments were performed by her, this injection experiment. And then we were able to essentially patch medial septal Chat-Cree positive cells. And you can see the channel of some YFP expression here. And these are 1 millisecond light pulses that we can then induce firing of action tensils in these cells. So if you look into the hippocampus, we find widespread channelrhodopsin YFP expression in all layers of hippocampus. And then my graduate student, Vishalia Sapote, started patching cells and photoactivating acetylcholine onto different subtypes. And pretty soon we realized that it was going to be very complex. So, for example, in the OLM cell, we got a very nice, what looked like a nicotinic response, maybe accompanied by a muscarinic sustained depolarization. And in other cell types, we actually got a hyperpolarization. And this is kind of work that's ongoing. Kind of relevant to epilepsy, wanted to ask whether blocking acetylcholinesterase could induce differences in our ability to photoactivate cells. And so we patched a couple of pyramidal cells, and you could see that in normal conditions, there's hardly any response in blue here. But in the presence of acetylcholinesterase, in which we can increase the diffusion of acetylcholine by reducing or eliminating its degradation to choline, we can see what look like kind of epileptic form just discharges. And so in a population of pyramidal cells, we were able to show that using tacrin as an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, we were able to basically show that increase volume transmission and generate these large discharges. And this became the basis of a grant in which we submitted initially as a center grant in collaboration with Chuck Thompson, who's a medicinal chemist at the University of Montana. And just recently it was scored but not funded, and so we repackaged this grant into an R21 grant. So that is kind of establishing the framework of in the feasibility, and we're a little further in the feasibility now for photoactivating acetylcholine onto different cell types. But we're also interested in visualizing these terminals. And so in collaboration with Emily Stone, we've gotten really into trying to do some quantification of the spatial localization of cholinergic afferents. And so we've done this through several approaches, one of which is taking our GFP-positive or interneuron subtypes, various transgenic mouse lines, and then counterstaining with the vesicular acetylcholine transporter to get essentially the 3D coordinates of acetylcholine release sites relative to the cell surface of interneuron subtypes. And so Emily has been able to work out that we can essentially map the distances, the minimal distances from each release site onto the surface of the cells, and obtain estimates of point-to-point versus volume transmission. And she could also take the surface of cells and map the minimal distance from the cell surface to the release site, what we think is the release site. And so that's the histogram here. And just recently, a mass grad student that Emily has been collaborating with has developed, in collaboration with John Graham, what is called a Ripley's case statistic. And essentially, we object count the cell and the somatodendritic surface, and the object count in image J boutons at relative distances from the cell surface. And then this case statistic will essentially quantify whether we see a clustering number of release sites, or randomized release sites, or regular release sites with respect to the cell surface marching out in different volumes. And so this is an example of what we see. These are confidence intervals for randomness in red here, and you can see that this is the empirical distribution. So we can see that it's the positive direction indicates more clustering, whereas the negative direction is more regularity. And so we're seeing in preliminary experiments some regularity, some clustering of terminals about the cell surface. Another tool that we're using to try to understand the spatial distribution of cholinergic terminals are these ChAT-GFP mice that Sukumar Vigraboman has generated, and he's published just recently on it. So these are mice in which GFP is conjugated to an axonal filament protein tau, and we get this spectacular signal to noise ratio, and we can fill neurons and then map the distribution of terminals relative to the surface of these filled cells. And So ultimately, what we want to do is go back to the channel rhodopsin expression and try to integrate the spatial information with the photoactivatable responses in cells. And so this is an example of an OLM cell that we filled. And so what we'd like to do is so we take this distribution, we object count the cell, get a volume fill, and then take and quantify the release sites relative to the cell surface. So in addition to mapping the distribution of terminals, Emily Stone has been active in helping us generate acetylcholine diffusion models so that she can essentially release acetylcholine from these 3D coordinates relative to the cell surface. So this is an example in which she has a diffusion model in which acetylcholinesterase is present, and then she can take out acetylcholinesterase and show that there's a broader, there's a longer diffusion spatially and temporally. So that's kind of the ultimate goal of what I'd like to do with these with this quantification. So how many minutes do I have? 5 minutes? Okay. All right. So the major thrust of my research right now is trying to look at point-to-point versus volume transmission. Another part of my grant is looking at network contributions. And what I proposed to do was to try to eliminate cholinergic specializations from different interneuron cell types. And initially, I chose M1 receptors on parvalbumin cells, in part because it seemed to be a much more simpler cholinergic phenotype in the sense that there's no M3 receptors present, and essentially deleting M1 receptors might silence essentially parvalbumin cells from cholinergic modulation. So I proposed to do network contributions, and initially I wanted to look at behavior as well, but that I thought was too ambitious. But I've kept this idea of behavior alive through various kind of undergraduate student grants, and we've made some progress in behavior actually that I would just want to cover in the next couple of minutes. So initially we wanted to be confident that our chat Cre mice, or I'm sorry, our PV Cre mice express Cre in parvalbumin cells only, and so we crossed the PV Cre mice with a ROSA YFP reporter line and did a counterstain with parvalbumin. And you can see that essentially the parvalbumin label overlaps very well with the ROSA YFP that is expressed in the PV Cre cells. And overall, we're based on this quantification here, we're pretty confident that virtually all PV cells express Cre. And that needed to be kind of an initial step towards being confident that we're eliminating M1 receptors from PV cells. So we also recorded from these PVYFP cells, and we got a lot of basket cells, which gave us confidence. We also saw fast spiking in these cells, and a very brief action potential, which is characteristic of PV basket cells. We also observed a lot of bistratified cells, and unfortunately, I didn't have the time to work up figures on those. Those bistratified cells haven't really been well characterized in terms of their response to muscarin, but they have very strong responses to muscarin. And so what we then did was we crossed TV Cre mice with these floxed M1 mice that we got from Tanogawa's lab at MIT and generated this PV Cre floxed M1 mice. And so essentially what that does is... I don't know why that's taking too long. Okay, what that does is that we have LOX P sites that are flanked by the M1 receptor, and then the presence of Cre in PV cells eliminates the M1 receptor from the genome. And in initial experiments, we found that there was a reduction in iPSC amplitude in the PV Cre floxed M1 heteros, and since then we've obtained a homozygous line of PV Cre floxed M1 mice, and we also saw a reduction in carbachol-induced oscillations. And in this case, we had excitation blocked, and we're looking at rhythmic iPSCs, and we saw that there's an impairment in generation of these rhythmic iPSCs in response to carbachol. All right, and in the last couple of minutes, I want to show some of the kind of exciting new behavioral experiments based on behavioral tests that we performed in the PDQ-FOXTM1 mice and their wild type lines. And so initially, we tested the mice in the open field maze because in global M1 knockout mice, there's a hyperactivity phenotype. And so we wanted to test whether there was a hyperactivity phenotype in the PDQ-FOXTM1 mice. And there isn't. They essentially are essentially the same as PDQ wild type. However, we did find that there is an impairment in recognition memory in the first 5 minutes. And this is done through a novel object recognition test. And you can see in normal mice, they spend more time with a novel object once it's replaced with a familiar object. But there's an impairment that's seen in PDQ-FOXTM1 mice. And we also went on just recently to do a T-maze test, which is a test of working memory. And the way that's done is basically you place a mouse in a T-maze, and it'll go to one side, and then it'll remember it went to that side. So when you start it over again on trial two, it'll go to the opposite side. And so normal mice that have intact working memory have they alternate basically with regularity going from trial to trial, and on average they get about 70% correct choices in our hands. And so what we did was we then made the trial a little harder. We inserted the 30-second delay between trials, and you can see that in the wild-type mice, there's still a memory that is left because chance is 50%, and it was not really different than the 1 second inner trial interval. But in the PDQ-FOXTM1 mice, we saw an impairment in the 30-second interval, suggesting that M1 receptors on PD cells play a role in memory retention. We saw no real impairment in the Morse-Watter maze, and suggesting that M1 receptors on PD cells don't play a role in spatial learning. And then relevant to epilepsy, in global M1 knockout mice, there's almost complete resistance to pilocarpine-induced seizures. So we wanted to test pilocarpine-induced seizures in PDQ-FOXTM1 mice. And using the open field maze apparatus, as any maze software, we're able to track the 3D the coordinates of movement in these mice. And you can see that pilocarpine induces a massive hypolocomotion. And this became also an assay in our cataract grant. So, let's see. So the way this works is that initially we add pilocarpine, we put the mouse in the maze, in the open field maze, and you can see there's a head bobbing, and which then progresses to single jerks, and then multiple jerks, and then you ultimately get to tonic-clonic seizures. And this was extremely reproducible in our wild-type mice. And this was also the seizure severity index is a subjective scale, but we had it blind. So we then tested the PDQ-FOXTM mice and the PDQ mice, and to our surprise, it's actually not what we predicted. We thought that impairing the ability of PD cells to be activated would result in a reduced seizure a reduction in seizure threshold. We actually saw a protection effect when you delete M1 receptors from PD cells, and that's shown here. There's a reduction in seizure severity. So that I know I'm running late. I'll wrap up right now. But anyway, this is the ongoing work that I'm doing, and I think the PDQ-FOXTM1 project is probably the most mature. I'll try to get that out soon. And so that's basically the state of my research. I'd like to acknowledge people who helped with the work. Kristen Keel de Rio did the PD and CCK basket cell work. Ludovic Tricor was important in establishing the single-cell PCR technique, and this was done in Chris McBain's lab initially with the help of his technician, Brian Jeffries, who did the biocyte and filling. We got the mice, GAD65 mice, from the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, Gabor Zadlos' lab. We got primers from Virun Kali, and Fernando and Francis were collaborators in the early work on the MCR. So at the University of Montana, the photoactivation of acetylcholine and PB3-floxetine-1 recordings were done by my graduate student, Vachelli, and she's finishing up right now. Also, April Johnston did some of the early PB3-floxetine-1 recordings, and she's now in Andre Fichon's lab. And then just recently, I interviewed a postdoc who will be coming in a couple of weeks, Feng Yi, who's from the Li lab at Shanghai. So he'll be starting and continuing on the Chanaroxin work. So there's Fernanda, and then there's Vlad, who has a poster outside, continuing work on compartmental modeling in the OLM cells. And there's Francis, and there's Emily Stone, who's been really, really important and quantifying both the presynaptic release stuff that I've been talking about. Mickey Smith is a graduate student who's doing the case statistic with John Graham. Then I have other lab members who helped me with imaging. Kurt Stoll is back here. Ben Holloway and Tavia Garrett are all important doing imaging work, and just and also Brian Bennett made that nice movie we saw. Jackson Ball is a graduate student, undergrad student, is now graduated. He's a technician in my lab now and is working with Mickey on the case statistic work. And then finally have Miriam Rose Baker. She came to my lab for a summer research project with some behavioral experiments, experience, and that's how we got started with behavior. And Eric Marceau and Kurt Stoll were important in the pilocarp-induced seizures. So this is my funding, NIH, NINDS, Epilepsy Foundation, Alzheimer's Association, the COBRA Center for Structural and Functional Neuroscience at the University of Montana was funded through the NCRR, and then the F-SCORE, the Montana NSF F-SCORE, and the MILES, and I Am Sure programs. Are kind of student grant programs at the University of Montana, and I've gotten students quite a lot of those, helped them get them. So, and that's all been important for the behavioral experiments. So, thanks for your attention. Sorry I ran late. So.